Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, what a wild ride through this complex, challenging, dynamic, sometimes unpredictable process that we call American democracy. The election is now behind us. The voters have chosen Donald Trump, who is now the president-elect. That decision likely means some very major changes for the American health system and the reform that has taken place.
Well, it does, Mark, and the campaign was indeed contentious, one of the most contentious maybe that we've ever seen. But in the end, Secretary Clinton was certainly gracious in her acknowledgement of her loss. And although the president-elect has vowed to repeal the Affordable Care Act, one of President Obama's signature policy achievements, the president welcomed Mr. Trump to the White House for an important face-to-face meeting and certainly made clear his commitment to a smooth transition of power. So, you know, I think, Mark, we have to say one of the positives is we've seen many moments of grace in the aftermath of this election, and that smooth transition of power is just so central to our democracy.
It really is. And, you know, many in the healthcare arena worked very hard to transition their practices and care delivery systems to meet the objectives of the Affordable Care Act. We saw the introduction of electronic health records throughout the hospital and primary care system. We saw practices building around quality measures and outcomes and care delivery based on value and not volume. The Affordable Care Act certainly has accelerated much progress in these quest for better health care, but still there's much work that remains to be done.
You know, I think we've said on the show over the years that to think of the Affordable Care Act as only synonymous with health insurance coverage was like taking a really great book and reading one chapter in the middle. Mm-hmm. That it was about so much more in terms of practice transformation and drivers in quality and improving technology. And I think so much has been accomplished in the country over these last years. When we look back, we began the show 7 years ago, really at the beginning of the health reform debate, so that we could tap into the best minds in the industry that were focused on creating meaningful health reform, really meaning just better health care for everybody. We hosted many thought leaders from the halls of academia to policy leaders, legislative leaders, groundbreaking innovators, so much creative intellectual capital working towards this quest for a better, fairer, more affordable healthcare system. And I honestly believe that that work is going to continue no matter what the changes in policy directives are under the new administration.
So we look forward to bringing all of those stories. There are many brilliant people on both sides of the aisle working in this space, and we are pleased to be a part of that, Margaret.
And our guest today is one of those many great thought leaders. Dr. Robert Blendon is the director of the Harvard Opinion Research Program. He has some very well-informed and unique insights into what the American public is looking for regarding health policies in this new era.
Laurie Robertson also checks in, managing editor of FactCheck.org, is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love hearing from you. Now, we'll get to our interview with Dr. Robert Blendon in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. President-elect Trump has begun to assemble his transition team, addressing one of his key campaign promises to repeal and replace Obamacare. Andrew Remberg has been tapped to lead the team. He spent 2 years advising Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, as well as Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's short-lived presidential campaign. He served previously in the Romney campaign and has been laying the groundwork for years on the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. As for the health industry leaders, they're anticipating changes governing their future business plans. The nation's top insurance CEOs gathered after the election, speculating on what lies ahead. Aetna CEO Bertolini anticipates several popular aspects of the health law will remain, young adults being able to stay on their parents' plan to age 26 and no penalty for pre-existing conditions. But they expect there will be more state-based approaches to Medicaid than was experienced under the Affordable Care Act. Meanwhile, House Speaker Paul Ryan is flexing some muscle. In a recent interview, he raised the specter of a privatized Medicare moving forward, in which recipients would be given vouchers to purchase insurance. For the time being, though, Obamacare open enrollment is underway. The new administration doesn't take office till after enrollment is closed on the online insurance marketplaces. Insurance signups are a priority in the waning months of the Obama administration. Secretary of Health and Human Services Sylvia Burwell recently tweeted that November 9th was healthcare.gov's best day, with 100,000 signups since it began selling the 2017 Obamacare plans November 1st. The government's goal is for more than 13.8 million signups initially. A rare and deadly fungal disease has been reported in the U.S. for the first time. The CDC reports at least 13 cases of an infection called Candida auris have been reported. The fungus is quite dangerous in that it's resistant to most antifungal medications, comes with a high mortality rate, and tends to afflict those with other underlying conditions. It's been found in several other countries, including the U.K., Japan, and South Korea. And pregnant, ecstatic, and bleary-eyed. Seems both men and women suffer significant sleep interruption during pregnancy, to say nothing of sleep deprivation once that bundle of joy comes home. A new study suggests sleep interruption is a fairly common occurrence during pregnancy. Overall, 12% of women and 15% of men had either insomnia or too little sleep, according to researchers. Those affected by loss of sleep also report higher incidence of depression, which can affect birth outcomes and also be a precursor to postpartum depression. Sleep disturbance and short sleep duration during pregnancy is also associated with an increased risk for adverse pregnancy outcomes, including preterm births, preeclampsia, and cesarean deliveries. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Robert Blunden, professor of health policy and political analysis at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's the director of the Harvard Opinion Research Program, which focuses on better understanding of public knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs about major social policy issues in the United States and other nations. He previously served as chairman of the Department of Health Policy and Management at the T.H. Chan School of Public Health and currently co-directs the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Harvard School of Public Health Project on Understanding Americans' Health Agenda. He's a member of the Institute of Medicine, of the National Academy of Science, and of the Council of Foreign Relations. He earned his MBA at the University of Chicago and his doctorate at the Johns Hopkins. Dr. Blunden, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
Well, may we live in interesting times, but maybe not this interesting.
Yes.
You certainly have had a catbird seat in terms of understanding the American views on health policy, and the American people have elected Donald Trump to become the next president of the United States, which is certainly going to have a major impact on the Affordable Care Act. And you've been charting this divide of views that Americans have about health policy for some time. And I'm wondering if you could tell us what role did health policy play in the election, and what do you think is going to happen?
So elections in real life are not referendums on a single issue. They create an environment where political leaders can move in one direction and not in another. So the healthcare issue was an important but a second-level issue in this election. The issues of the economy, of terrorism, of immigration, character of the candidates appear to be more dominant than healthcare. What has happened since this law was enacted 6 years ago is that the country, particularly people who identify either as Democrats or Republicans, have become almost an ocean apart in what should happen. Democrats believe as a whole this bill is working well. When asked what should happen, it not only should be implemented, but now the majority of Democratic voters would want it expanded. Republicans continue to believe that this bill is really working very poorly. It was a mistake for the country in the first time. When you offer Republican voters what do they want done, most actually choose scaling it back or repealing it. And then when they look at different plans, things that have much less central role for the federal government, tax credits for people, This is an issue which is the equivalent of an ocean between two groups. So it didn't decide the election, but the fact that you have a Republican president, a Republican Congress, is going to lead them to follow through in some part to the agenda they've expressed for 6 years. That is, from the day this law was passed, they believe that its approach, its intervention in the healthcare and medicine in America was wrong, and it didn't look as if they were going to have a chance to dramatically change it. In fact, had Hillary Clinton won, the discussions would be about expanding this law. Mm-hmm. So you're going to see very serious proposals by Republicans to really scale this back, change its name, make it more limited, and change the federal role. And it could have a powerful impact on the 20 million people who are directly being aided by this law. On the other side, a substantial number of Republican voters believe that this law is driving their health care costs. Mm-hmm. It's making it more expensive for them. It's led to their insurance having higher deductibles, higher premiums. So for many of them, if this bill is scaled back, they see this as a relief for them. But this is one of the issues in American life, and it's really for people from other countries sort of shocking mm-hmm. how far apart people who live in the same communities can be on what federal government should be doing about health care, and was this the right or wrong decision?
Well, Dr. Blendon, you know, I think one of the phrases that I heard the most in this most recent period of time was, I didn't see this coming. And you are so well-versed in the science of polling. And in fact, I learned you've been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for a series of polls that you conducted in partnership with the Washington Post and the Kaiser Family Foundation. So based on your expertise and experience with polling, how is it that the polls seem to have been so off this time around? Has polling become just less precise? Are we not reaching the right people? What's your explanation for the fact that the polls seem to have been wrong so much of the time this round?
So I believe the average, and I was surprised with everyone else, regardless of, okay. Of all that I know. So in a national election, only 55% of adults who live in the United States end up actually voting. So these polls, they interview people and try to figure out who will be the 55 and who will be the 45% that don't vote. And what happened here is that they were wrong. And so they underreported many people, particularly white American voters who are mostly older, who had not voted in either 2012 or the 2014 election, were very highly motivated in this election, mm-hmm. and particularly in the four Midwestern states, uh-huh. they came out and voted at much larger numbers than the polls identified. Huh. Secretary Clinton actually won the popular right. vote, and it had to do with the polls missing people who hadn't voted before. And one of the ways that happens is you're sitting about, how do I figure out if you're going to vote? So I ask you, did you vote in the last election? You say no. Then you ask you, did you vote in the election before? No. Then I just sort of check, even if you say you're going to vote, well, uh-huh. you're probably not going to vote. Uh-huh. And so those people, a very substantial share of them in the Middle West that hadn't voted before, voted in this election. And they voted for Donald Trump. First, you find out who lives in the United States. And then the second question is you try to figure out, are they actually going to vote? It really is a mistake, and they're going to have to go back to the drawing boards to figure out how to interview people and get a better sense if you hadn't voted before, are you going to vote this time? But it essentially, at least the media polling group were really taken by surprise. There was a consensus here that she was not going to win by a landslide, but she was going to win and she was going to carry those states.
You know, I want to get back to your comment earlier that we're oceans apart in terms of our perspective on the Affordable Care Act. And I know you do some collaborative work with the Kaiser Family Foundation. We had Drew Altman, the CEO, on who shared the same perspective. But when you start to drill down on the Affordable Care Act and look at elements of it, where do you see the seam of opportunity for elements of the Affordable Care Act to continue and how it will play out?
So what is it that Republican voters don't like? They do not like that people are required to buy insurance and to buy a policy whose design has been set by the federal government. There's also a requirement that businesses have to contribute for their employees, and many small business people feel that that is a real threat to their business. So you say to Republican voters, what bothers you? They don't say having kids on the plan to age 26, and they don't say to you that they're against pre-existing conditions. What they say to you is the government shouldn't be requiring every person, whether or not they want insurance or not, to have it. And the government has all types of regulations about what has to go in healthcare and how people are going to be paid and what computers they have to use. So I am sure the protecting people under age 26 will remain. There will be some sort of protections for people with pre-existing conditions. There will be some subsidies for low-income people. And that is what bothers conservatives and Republicans. They believe those requirements are driving up the insurance costs of other people. They also think it is too expensive. We're on the Democratic side. People really think more people have to be covered. So there's, again, this huge divide.
Well, Dr. Blendon, you know, we look and we say, well, 20 million Americans have gained coverage. But for sure, those in the middle and upper incomes who don't qualify for tax subsidies are certainly feeling besieged by big out-of-pocket costs. And it seems as though everybody blames the Affordable Care Act. But when you look at this, what is your answer to these higher out-of-pocket costs?
Healthcare costs have been a rising issue for 20-some years in the United States. And a lot of people blame the Affordable Care Act. If you are not receiving a subsidy from the government, you are looking at rising premiums, higher deductibles, and copays. And at the moment, for a lot of people, the Affordable Care Act has been what they blame. And then you say to yourself, wow, there's a lot of people who aren't getting help from the law. What do they worry about? And they worry about their own affordability through their employer policy. Probably 10% of Americans are getting insurance from these exchanges. But Republican voters who are not mostly benefiting from this law think it's been harmful. Democratic voters, many of them don't benefit either, but they believe that it's been helpful. So it's a debate about what you believe the government should be doing here in the future and how government action helps people who aren't directly getting subsidies. People just yell at each other. And so when you listen to the Republican leadership talk, they believe middle-income people are worse off. And when you listen to the Democratic leadership talk, they feel that people are really a lot better off. And the truth is probably in between.
We're speaking today with Dr. Robert Blendon, professor of health policy and political analysis at the Harvard School of Public Health. He's the director of the Harvard Opinion Research Program. Dr. Blendon, you conduct hundreds of studies on a variety of topics from healthcare to economics and social policy. And you wrote earlier this year about what makes Americans dissatisfied with their health system and how it compares internationally. So how do American views stack up around the globe?
People who are in high-income European countries or even Canada, the people who live in those countries rate their systems better. We have more people suffering economic insecurity about health care costs than other countries. More Americans worry about how they're going to pay their health care bills than are true in other countries. People in other countries generally trust their governments more than the United States.
Huh.
And the United States at the moment has an extraordinary high level of cynicism towards how the federal government goes about its work and business and decision making. And if you are a politician visiting the United States from other countries, what strikes you is the parties don't have battles over health care the way that they do in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So we have less satisfaction, but we have this very high level of distrust of government. And I wrote a paper years ago, when it comes to health policy, Americans aren't British. And so it's hard to just transfer systems over because we don't know how to transfer feelings about government.
Dr. Blendon, you're throwing me back to the memory of the town halls in the summer of 2009.
Yes.
9 people would say, down with Obamacare and get your hands off my Medicare. But, you know, in all truth, Medicare and I think surprisingly Medicaid recipients are pretty satisfied with the coverage and the care that they get under those two big public plans. But House Speaker Ryan, for one, has spoken of not only eliminating Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, but also moving towards privatizing Medicare and maybe even delaying Medicare eligibility until age 67. What do you see as the possibility of that happening?
President-elect Trump ran all the way along saying, I am not going to touch Social Security or Medicare. Speaker Ryan has been saying for many years that Medicare is too expensive and we have to move to limit its future expenditures. It has financial problems, and he's proposed fixed limits on contributions, of moving the retirement age. This is going to be a real battle. So in the politics, from the voter point of view, Medicare and Social Security are the two most popular domestic programs in the United States. So people across the aisles feel good about those programs. That, from his point of view, is going to be a huge battle. Medicaid is in the middle. Medicaid is an established program, but it doesn't have the same wide public popularity as Medicare or Social Security. And so trying to cut people off Medicaid will not be easy. So he's going to have a battle in reducing the Medicaid coverage. He's going to have a huge battle over changing Medicare. In the surveys we were involved in, most Republican voters don't support a number of his proposals. They're arguing give the states more authority, which may or may not move forward. But so the ACA turns out to be the most politically vulnerable of the big health care laws because it doesn't have a Republican constituency.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me pick up on that thread, yeah, too, because you referenced bipartisan support and that there was not a constituency, any support from the Republicans on the Affordable Care Act. And we had David Gergen on the show, sort of a wise man who opined that having bipartisan support is very important. He sort of walked through the history of the Medicare legislation, Medicaid, civil rights legislation. These are settled matters because they have this bipartisan support. Aren't we going to end up in the same position on the Affordable Care Act if it gets repealed, because it will not have bipartisan support and we will be back at another election at another time, even in the repeal side, unless there is sort of a bipartisan support? Aren't we just on the other side of the coin looking backwards with the same sort of oceans apart endgame?
So let's record your line and play it over and over all day long, because I 100% agree. What we're going to have, let's assume they cut back parts of this and repeal parts of it. When the Democrats come back in, there's going to be another piece of major legislation. A large share of Americans feel very vulnerable for health insurance coverage and costs, and the Democrats, it's part of their genetic code. And the only way that we can ultimately move forward is we have to find some compromise that can have bipartisan support. This will be in the next Democratic agenda with another plan. And if it's enacted by only Democrats, you'll have the same cycle. And so there needs to find some way to have an agreement of a plan but can satisfy some of the concerns of Republicans and Democrats. You just can't go on this way. So we're going to have to find a way through American politics to reach a compromise with a law that Republicans may not love but can live with, and Democrats, in order to have some stability, go along with it. And we're not there now. If the election hadn't gone so much to the Republican side, there might have been a compromise between a Democratic president and a more Republican compromise. But at the moment, the party suddenly found out, one party, that they have the ability to shape that agenda.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Robert Blendon, director of the Harvard Opinion Research Program at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. You can learn more about their work by going to harvard.hsph.edu/HORP. Dr. Blendon, thank you so much for joining us
on
Conversations on Healthcare today. Very fascinating insights, and we really appreciate your wisdom.
Good. I'll talk to everybody again, and
all
thank
right.
you.
Thank you, Joe. Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Now that Donald Trump has been elected president, what may happen to the Affordable Care Act? Trump vowed on the campaign trail to repeal and replace it, though it could be some time before that happens or consumers see any impact. Vice President-elect Mike Pence said in early November that there would be a transition period for those receiving government subsidies and Congress would need to pass replacement legislation. Let's look at some of the statistics under the law. Millions have gained health insurance. The Obama administration puts the number at 20 million, and figures from the National Health Interview Survey conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention support that. Those figures show a drop in the number of uninsured since 2010, the year the law was passed, of 21.3 million. Not all of that decline in the uninsured would be due to the law, of course. The ACA has expanded coverage in two main ways, by expanding eligibility for Medicaid coverage in the 31 states plus Washington, D.C. that have implemented that expansion, and by offering subsidies and new insurance protections for those buying their own coverage. For instance, insurers now can't deny coverage or charge higher premiums for pre-existing conditions. In the Medicaid program, 15.7 million people have been enrolled since October 2013, when the ACA marketplaces first started operating. Individuals were required to have insurance or pay a fee effective January 1, 2014. As for the ACA marketplaces, 10.4 million people had marketplace coverage in the first half of 2016, and 84% of them, that's 8.8 million people, received tax credits that lowered their out-of-pocket costs for premiums. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office and Joint Committee on Taxation have periodically estimated the impact on the federal budget of repealing the ACA. The latest report from last year estimated that repealing the law would increase federal deficits by $137 billion over a decade, including macroeconomic effects. As for the impact on health insurance coverage, the groups estimated that the number of uninsured would increase by 19 million in 2016. That's for a full repeal of the law. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. You have cancer. These are words nobody wants to hear. Not only does the diagnosis conjure fear of the ravages of a potentially life-threatening illness, but it implies months of sickness associated with chemotherapy and other treatments. But a device that's already been approved for use in Europe and has just been approved by the FDA in this country can mitigate one of the more unpleasant side effects of hair loss. The DignaCap is a skull cap placed on the heads of chemo patients that cools the scalp and limits chemotherapy's toxic impact on the rapidly dividing cells in hair follicles.
Scalp cooling does in no way diminish the effectiveness of chemotherapy, nor does it increase the risk of recurrence.
That was Dr. Hope Rugo speaking to NBC News recently. She led the clinical trials at five different hospitals testing the efficacy of the DignaCap, which cools the scalp to 37 degrees, and that's cold enough to inhibit cell death in hair follicles.
You didn't choose to get your cancer. You can't affect the chemotherapy. This gives you something that you can do for yourself.
70% of the women in the trial kept more than 50% of their hair. And some, like Donna Tukes of Connecticut, kept all of it. She was selected for the trial after her husband, musician Daryl Tukes, wrote a letter asking that his wife be considered for the U.S. trial.
But I wrote a letter to several of the doctors conducting them.
And, a wonderful letter.
Donna has a head full of beautiful thick hair. A unique feature that is a shock of whiteness, creating a halo for her young face.
Not only did his wife keep her hair, her doctors say her early diagnosis and treatment have yielded an excellent outcome, cancer-free. DignaCap, a scalp-chilling device for patients undergoing chemotherapy, helping to preserve a sense of identity and dignity while enduring the rigors of cancer treatment and mitigating one of the most emotionally challenging side effects of that treatment, hair loss. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.